real patriots, the people who don't love their country as a mindless abstract, but who love and care for the people in that country and want to see them treated justly. And treated justly means that we don't have to give the largest portion of our income in taxes so that the rich can keep siphoning off this money from the public treasury, and that we can use this money for the well-being of the people. That's the real patriotism.
And you're tuned to Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Today is July 3rd, 2002, and you just heard the voice of Michael Parenti. We'll be hearing an interview with Michael Parenti, radical thinker and author of more than 15 books, including most recently The Terrorism Trap, September 11th and beyond. We'll be speaking with Dr. Parenti on this 4th of July weekend show. Also later in the program, I'll be talking with Dr. Cecilia Elizabeth O'Leary, Assistant Professor of History at Cal State University at Monterey Bay. And we'll be discussing the recent Federal Appeals Court ruling regarding the Pledge of Allegiance. All that is coming up next here on Rockin' the Boat. Stand by, stay tuned. Michael Parenti in just a moment. Arguably one of the country's foremost radical thinkers is Michael Parenti. Since receiving his PhD in political science from Yale University in 1962, Dr. Parenti has taught at a number of colleges and universities in the U.S. and abroad. He has authored 15 books on such topics as history, democracy, fascism, U.S. imperialism, communism, terrorism, globalization, racism, gender, and class. Among his published works are Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, The Politics of News Media, Against Empire, The Sword and the Dollar, Imperialism, Revolution, and the Arms Race, and most recently, his most recent book is titled The Terrorism Trap, September 11th and Beyond. Dr. Michael Parenti has also written hundreds of articles which have been published in a wide array of newspapers, magazines, and other periodicals, including Covert Action Quarterly, The Monthly Review, Dollars and Cents, Prevailing Winds, The Humanist, New Political Science, Nature, Society and Thought, The Nation Magazine, Z Magazine, and many others too numerous to mention here. His writings have been translated into over 12 languages and have been enjoyed by readers, academics, and social activists alike. Dr. Michael Parenti appears on radio and television talk shows to discuss current issues and ideas from his published works. His talks and commentaries are played on radio stations and to enthusiastic audiences in the U.S., Canada, and around the globe. In recent years, he has devoted himself full-time to writing and lecturing. I spoke with Dr. Parenti by telephone prior to the program, and in the interview we discuss the subject of his latest book, The Terrorism Trap, September 11th and Beyond, the true nature of the U.S. military's presence throughout the planet, and the recent federal appeals court ruling on the Pledge of Allegiance. We begin with a general discussion on what it means to be a patriot.
Webster's dictionary defines the term patriot as one who loves his country and zealously supports its authority and interests. Listed as a synonym with this definition is the word nationalist. What images are conjured up in your mind, Michael Parenti, when you hear this definition of a patriot?
I think the definition does seem to imply that a patriot is someone who promotes his own nation and his own national identity above that of other people's. By my view of patriotism, I think a real patriot is someone who feels a love and attachment for all the peoples of the world. He's a patriot of humanity. He can also be an American patriot in the sense that he's proud of some parts of his heritage, of the courageous struggles of many people to advance the quality and justice and democracy in their lives, he can also be a patriot while being less than proud, but fully informed of other aspects of his nation's history and how its rich and powerful rulers have often abused immigrant peoples, Native American peoples, how they've abused the environment, how they've pursued ruthlessly self-interest with no regard for their country. So I would ask you, who's a better patriot? You who are concerned about the quality of our environment, our air, our drinking water, or President Bush, who is undermining these things and right now sending out executive orders that are designed to undermine and eliminate pollution controls? If you love your country, you want it to be clean and livable in. Who's more of a patriot? You who wants to see the public treasure spent on decent public education and decent health care for everyone? Or President Bush, who wants to roll back and cut back and subvert these things and spend money on missiles and depleted uranium bombs and the like? How does that make him a better patriot than I, you see? So, and you can run down the things. I think the greatness of your country is to be measured not by the ability to bomb the cities and villages and townships and countrysides of other people, destroying them, contaminating them, mangling them, demoralizing and shattering their societies. I don't think that makes you a great nation. Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany was able to do that. I never thought of Nazi Germany as a great nation. I thought of it as a evilly led and evil, propelled by evil. The greatness of a nation should be measured by the ability of a nation to provide a decent life for all its citizenry, by the viability and creativity of its institutions, by the equity and justice in its social arrangements. That's what real patriotism is about, and that's what my goal is. Unfortunately, as you know, Vineet, that in our country, patriotism is very often associated with two very unfortunate and really destructive and really un-American things. One is racial superiority of a sort, you know. We're better than anybody else, and that's the way it is, and looking down on immigrants and such. And the other, with militarism. It's associated with militarism.
Growing up in this country, children learn that to be patriotic, they must, quote-unquote, support the troops. So my next question, leading right into what you're probably about to talk about, is the true nature of the U.S. military's presence throughout the planet. In your latest book, The Terrorism Trap, September 11th and Beyond, you point out that the United States military apparatus consists of over 500,000 troops who are stationed on some 400 bases in at least 35 countries.
Mm-hmm.
As well, you note that since World War II, the U.S. government has doled out more than $240 billion in direct military aid to more than 80 countries. And this buildup is justified to us, the American people, as necessary to safeguard us from terrorism, as well to protect the military's host countries from being attacked. So my question is, who are the beneficiaries of this massive U.S. military presence throughout the world?
Well, it is mostly a military presence to prevent social change in various countries. It's to make sure that in country after country in Latin America, Asia, and Africa, that the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the markets will be open completely to international corporate investors on terms that are completely favorable to the international corporate investors. And any country or any leader, whether it be Torrio in Panama or Noriega in Panama or Saddam Hussein in Iraq or Milosevic in Yugoslavia or Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, any leader who tries an alternative path, who wants to take some other variant or independent path of self-development for his own people, that leader will be targeted and will be demonized and will be called a ruthless scoundrel. By the way, one of those leaders I mentioned is a ruthless scoundrel, and that's Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was CIA. He was put in Iraq to stop the Iraqi revolution, and he murdered the Kurdish Democratic Party, destroyed it. He murdered communists and progressives, and he even slaughtered the whole left wing of his own Ba'athist Party. And so he was the State Department and the White House's sweetheart. He was fine until he started doing economic nationalism and looking for a better deal on oil prices, and then moving against Kuwait because of their slant drilling into his oil fields over the border, under the border. So that's when he suddenly was demonized as worse than Hitler, and that's when the U.S. began its decade-long war of attrition and horror against the Iraqi people. They suffered. They've suffered because of Saddam Hussein. So let's see. I'm trying to get back to what the original question was that you posed. Why the U.S. is pursuing this kind of world empire? Why does it need this global military apparatus? It is the leading country when it comes to making the world safe for the Fortune 500 and corporate capitalism. Those things, that's not what they tell the American people. They tell the American people, we got to protect you from communism, we got to protect you from this, that, and the other thing. And now, the terrorist attacks of September 11 were a golden opportunity. I mean, you and I look at that September 11 and see a horrible incident. They look at it and see a golden opportunity. I mean, it was just wonderful how it served their interest to escalate the military budget, roll back our civil liberties, give the internal security agencies a freer and freer hand to intrude and control. And all those powers given under the guise of fighting terrorism aren't fighting terrorism. All those powers are going to be used, you know, for instance, this power of the FBI under the USA Patriot Act. The FBI now has the power to check any librarian in a library and see who is taking out what books where. That's going to be used against political dissenters. They're not doing a damn thing about terrorism. They still can't stop guns and explosives from getting through the airport checks. I don't know if you saw today's paper or yesterday's, which showed that, at least as reported in the San Francisco Chronicle, some 15 guns or 15% of the weapons they used dummy weapons got through undetected, and explosives got through undetected. I mean, the actual security measures, the security around our nuclear power plants is almost non-existent. If we've had private planes have flown back and forth over the power plants, and nobody scrambled to come up and challenge them or call them down or anything. So they're doing very little for real homeland security. They're doing really very little in hunting down the cells of perpetrators. Most of those arrests and such have been done by Interpol or European or Middle East police. No, what Bush has been interested in doing is waging a war in Afghanistan, which gives him hegemony over Afghanistan, allows him to station U.S. troops in various other surrounding countries, get their oil pipeline through, cut back on human services under the guise that this money is now needed for the war against terrorism, keep the country in a siege psychology. You heard what he said when it happened. He said, this is the first war of the 21st century. He announced it. He didn't say, let's hope this is the last war, or we mustn't have any war in the 21st century. He said, this is the first war, yippee, with lots more to come. And he saw that when you send troops out and there's a crisis and there's a danger, then the people start treating the president the way they treat God. They start huddling around him and looking to him for leadership, guidance, and salvation. And he's fully aware of that. And on September 10, his ratings were at a paltry 41% or so, or less than that. And on September 12, his ratings were 75, 80, 90%. I think they've slumped since then back down to the high 60s or whatever. It depends on which poll you look at. But anyway,
why do you think it is that people rush around the president, especially this president, who some say has no legitimate claim to the office he holds?
Well, just as I said, in a crisis, they all huddle around the leader and look to him for salvation. That's one. Two, when the military is committed and there's a war, they rally around the president. The military commitment stirs up their patriotism, and they're waving flags. They got flags on their cars, they got flags in their windows, and they got flags like this is going to solve something. Well, that's fine. It's our flag, too. It's the American flag. Big deal. It doesn't mean that it's solving anything and it's really answering to the issues of the day. He can get you to wave your flag and run around and salute and pledge allegiance under God or not under God, whoever. But that isn't going to protect us against terrorism, and that isn't going for future terrorist attacks, and that isn't going to solve the immense problems of this country, nor does it solve the problems which the U.S. national security state has been creating around the world.
In late May, FBI agent Colleen Rowley came forward with testimony that the FBI, in fact, might have missed warnings about some of the alleged 9/11 hijackers. And this news seems to have fueled some speculation that the Bush administration, you know, in conjunction or in operation with other elements of the national security state, were behind these attacks. Do you think there's any credibility to this notion that the September 11th attacks are akin to what some have said is Hitler's burning of the Reichstag?
No, the Reichstag was just, it was so obviously he burned it and he set it up and that. No, they weren't behind the attacks in the sense that they didn't script these attacks and they didn't pay for and plan them. The truth is they had been funding the people who had been doing it. They gave Osama bin Laden license, isn't that right? They let him leave the country. He'd come in. He had been funded by the CIA years ago. The CIA had contacts with al-Qaeda. They knew something was up, let's put it this way. They did know that something was going to happen. Now that, my friend, is not a speculation. That's public record. They've said it. They've come out and admitted as much. Condoleezza Rice, you heard what she said about a month ago. She said, we knew that some planes would be hijacked, but we thought it would be a hostage situation. Now, I find that very interesting. I mean, I find that very interesting. We knew there's going to be a hijacking plane, and they were just sitting there. They even had a good idea who the people were. I mean, they had information that there was this group of young men from the Middle East all arriving around the same time looking for visas and enlisting, enrolling in aviation, what is that called, aviation school or flying school? What do you, for flying lessons. And showing no interest in how to take off or land, just wanted to learn how to fly. Excuse me, hello? So they knew and they didn't mind. And the reason they don't mind is because they know every time there's a terrorist attack, there's a real good terrorist attack that can hit on U.S. soil that would put the country right behind the White House, put them in step, and they could push their agenda. And that's exactly what they did. And on September 12th, the Wall Street Journal, as I pointed out in the terrorism trap, the Wall Street Journal instructed George Bush, said, this is a good time for you to be able to push through your tax cut for the very rich, roll back environmental controls, open up the Arctic for drilling for oil, and drastically increase military spending. We now, the American taxpayer now ponies up $400 billion a year. I mean, that's more than all the other industrial countries put together spend on military spending. The second closest country is Russia with $51 billion. What is all that for? The Pentagon now admits that there's $1.2 trillion over the last 20 years that they cannot account for. Now, you don't misplace $1.2 trillion. Somebody's getting this money. Somebody's pocketing it, and it's getting siphoned off. So this is the kind of kleptocracy we have here, this kind of theft and corruption that's been going on really big time.
We're speaking with Michael Parenti, noted author. His latest book is entitled The Terrorism Trap. It's available through City Lights Books. In this, in the days after September 11th, a remarkable thing happened. All television advertising stopped for a day, and the networks were sharing footage with each other, which was an unprecedented move in the world of profit-driven news reporting. This was pointed to, you know, as that good old American spirit of kinship and sharing. I'm curious what your thoughts were as you watched the reporting on September 11th and the reporting that has happened since in the mainstream corporate press.
Well, as I mentioned in the terrorism trap, I was impressed by the fact that the news media not only echoed the officialdom line, especially if it's a conservative in power, and not only faithfully echoed like a lapdog the national security state line, we've always known that that's what they do, but the news media actually went into business for itself. It actually cleared the ground on September 12, before any politician dare utter it. The news media were busy making... clearing the road, creating a climate of opinion that enabled them to do the things they did. I mean, I remember, I would say it was actually on September 11 itself, by noontime of that day, I heard Tom Brokaw saying, "This is war. We are at war." And then another announcer on NBC saying, "Americans have taken their freedoms for granted, but they may have to give up some of those freedoms for security reasons." So they were already saying things which no politician uttered until a good week later. And they were repeating these things again and again. We have to go to war. We're going to have to strike. Brokaw even said, when are we going to really strike and hit them in real force and really get an army moving against these terrorists? So the media is not just a lapdog that faithfully echoes the official line. It actually, like any good instrument of propaganda, it actually goes out and clears the way and helps generate a certain climate of labeling and imagery and whatever.
I want to get back a little bit more on the subject of patriotism. We mentioned a little bit earlier about the American flag, and I just was struck by the amount of symbols that we have here in this country to express our civic pride. We have, for example, fireworks on the 4th of July, Rockwell's famous portrait of Rosie the Riveter, Uncle Sam, and as you mentioned, the American flag. I'm struck, though, how many of our symbols that we have of our patriotism are linked with military conquest, and I'm curious if you have any thoughts on this topic.
Yes, a lot of patriotic symbols are war memorials, war symbols, that sort. Statues of servicemen serving their country. I mean, are you really serving your country when you're killing villagers in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and Philippines and Afghanistan? Are you really serving your country? Is this serving your country? You know, patriotism is a... I already did at the beginning, I think, made that distinction between that brand of patriotism which defines itself in terms of military prowess and violence and war, and that brand of patriotism that defines itself and its strength in terms of the just and good life, which doesn't mean you have to be completely disarmed and indifferent to other people. But if the U.S. had been pursuing policies that were beneficial for the people of our own country, first of all, we wouldn't have a country where the military has $1 trillion they misplaced and never even got around to spending on the things they were supposed to spend it, and at the same time have schools where the roofs are leaking and the water's coming through, and communities that don't have enough money for essential services, for shelters for the homeless, for daycares, for working women. I mean, you can go on. What we have is this immense private wealth and military glut and public poverty, so that the empire devours the resources of the republic in order that patricians may pursue their far-off plunder, in order that it can maintain this control. But that kind of control has really led other people to hate us. When the U.S. goes in and the CIA goes in and destroys democratic and popular movements in Turkey and Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan and Egypt and Yemen and Syria, I mean, reformist movements in Lebanon, and supports Israel in their attack on the West Bank and Palestinian community, that leads only to hatred of America and Americans. And even there, I think Osama bin Laden and others like him are wrong. You shouldn't hate America and Americans. America is an entity of 280 million people, widely diverse people. It's U.S. leaders who have been pursuing these kind of policies in our name, using our tax money to go off and make the world safe for the Fortune 500, make sure that no reform movements come up, that no strong indigenous organizations and institutions develop which can say, hey, wait a minute, we don't want General Motors in here. We want to use this land and these resources for ourselves, for our own people, you know? And it wouldn't hurt us. It would add to our prosperity if the rest of the world were prosperous too. They'd buy more from us. They'd have better things to sell to us. But it would cut drastically into the profits of those big corporations that depend on getting these natural resources for a song and using the cheap labor of these countries. That doesn't help the American economy, by the way. When you close factories in Ohio to go move to China or in Indonesia, where you can pay people 15 cents an hour instead of $15 an hour, that's not helping the American people. And they can make things so much cheaper over there, but that doesn't really lead to a cheaper commodity here. When Nike closed all its stateside factories and moved to Indonesia, where they were paying people 12 cents, children, young girls, 14-year-old girls, 12 cents an hour for Nike shoes, they didn't, and to make a pair of shoes with all the outsourcing and shipping all the material all the way over there, the labor was so cheap, it cost them about $7 for a pair of shoes. They didn't come back and sell it to us any cheaper. They're still selling those shoes for $150, $200, $90 a pair, whatever. They don't go and do all that to give you a better buy. They do all that to widen their margin of profit. So the American people are paying the cost of this empire in taxes, in the loss of jobs, in the incredible damage to their environment, the environment around the globe, because it's all one environment, and even the environment at home. The biggest single polluter of our environment at home is the U.S. military, which, by the way, is under no pollution restrictions or controls. Military nuclear plants are under no restrictions and controls the way civilian nuclear plants are, as inadequate as those restrictions are. So this is where and these are the hidden costs of this empire, which Americans really should be looking at. You know, just to wave the flag and wave the flag doesn't make you a patriot. You know, Jesus said in the Bible, he said, not everyone who saith, Lord, Lord, shall enter unto the kingdom of heaven. And I say here too, not everyone who starts chanting USA, USA is really a great patriot.
So on June 26th, President Bush termed a ridiculous decision, a federal appeals court in San Francisco ruled 2-1 that the phrase "under God" and the Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional. I wanted to get you to comment on a June 28th opinion piece entitled "Trivializing a Big Issue: Exactly Who's Victimized by the Existence of the Words Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance." This was written by the editors of the daily Santa Cruz Sentinel, and in the opinion piece they asked the following. In a world in which innocent people are murdered, in which people lose their life's savings because of lying and cheating by financial leaders, in which schools are failing, who really wants to worry about two words in the Pledge of Allegiance? We can't imagine that any single person has been prevented from pursuing his or her freedom of expression in any way because of those two words in the Pledge of Allegiance. What next? Recalling all coins and dollar bills because of the In God We Trust line? Michael Parenti, what is your reaction to this opinion piece?
Well, in a way, there's a partial truth in the sense that it's not really such a big issue given all the emotional attention that's being given to that issue. But the truth of the matter is, I was raised on the Pledge of Allegiance. We said one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I don't even know if getting kids to chant the Pledge of Allegiance like little parrots, if that really is the training for patriotism. There really should be a separation of church and state. That was intended by the founding fathers. They did not believe in any establishment of a religion. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law relating to establishment of religion. The whole issue is really blown out of proportion to that degree. On the other hand, I don't believe in the glorification of religion. It's religious zealots who bombed the World Trade Center, who destroyed the World Trade Center and killed the people in those airplanes. Religions, the history of religions, has been a horrible history. Most people don't even know that history. The history of Christianity and the history of Islam and the history of Hinduism and even the history of Buddhism, which is supposedly the one peaceful religion. There are Buddhist armies fighting each other in Tibet for centuries. I mean, how do you think the Dalai Lama got all that wealth and all that land? It wasn't just sitting there with his prayer beads. Today you've got Buddhists fighting Christians from Nigeria to Sri Lanka. So the history of religions has been a history of murder and slaughter and mayhem and hatred and intolerance and vehemence. And I mean, the history of Christianity is just horrendous and horrible. We know little bits of it, but you got to study it in more detail. It's not just the Inquisition and all. It just went on and on from the very beginning, from the very first centuries, the fights of different Christians against each other, killing each other and whatever, the Manichaeans and this heresy and that heresy. So we can't separate religion from the things that are done in its name. And what's done in religion's name is some very beautiful, charitable, self-sacrificing things, helpful things, human, caring things, just things. And what's also done in religion's name is some brutal, horrible, murderous things, many. So this eagerness to marry religion with patriotism is just part of what we've been talking about. That particular brand of patriotism, that chanting, mindless, flag-waving patriotism, which goes out and says, let's kill them, and that particular brand of religion, which says, Lord, 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 under God, intolerant, holier than thou, both those things, I just have no care for and no feel for at all.
Finally, what advice would you recommend for leftist activists in dealing with that very attitude? We often hear we're often accused of being terrorists or traitors or told to move to Canada or some other such nonsense, but how do you deal with that when you get accused of those types of things?
Well, when people say to me, well, if you don't like this country, why don't you leave? I say, well, this is my country. Don't tell me to leave. The American way is to help change and improve. If we had this attitude of never complain and accept everything they come down on us with, we wouldn't have any Social Security, we wouldn't have any public education, we wouldn't have any kind of environmental controls as inadequate as they are. we wouldn't have anything. We'd all be working like in 1900 for 15 cents an hour. I mean, in 1900, the U.S. was a third world country a half a century before the term was invented. Mass poverty, unemployment, typhoid and tuberculosis epidemics, the diseases of the poor, child labor, no labor unions to speak of, really, no public education or public health to really speak of, no job security, no nothing. It was a century of struggle. Those are the real patriots, the people who don't just love their country as a mindless abstract, but who love and care for the people in that country and want to see them treated justly. And treated justly means that we don't have to give the largest portion of our income in taxes so that the rich can keep siphoning off this money from the public treasure, and that we can use this money for the well-being of the people. That's a real patriotism.
All right, we've been speaking with Michael Perenni, noted author. Michael, could you give our listeners some contact information? You mentioned your website is michaelperenti.org.
Michael Perenti is one word. Perenti is spelled parent with an I at the end, P-A-R-E-N-T-I, www.michaelperenti.org. And there you can see the list of my books, and there are some selections from them and some articles and the like. That's about it. The most recent books have been the one you mentioned, The Terrorism Trap, and just before that, I wrote a book called To Kill a Nation, The Attack on Yugoslavia, which is just coming out this week in paperback, and another book called History as Mystery, which deals with some of that stuff about religion I was telling you about.
Some summer reading for our listeners there.
There you go.
All right. Well, Michael, it's been a real pleasure.
Very good, and I hope the people who listen in give full support to you. You're doing good work. Thank you.
Well, they could hardly wait to get their triggers loaded when the airplanes hitting the towers exploded. You should have seen them on the big TV. It was the first great war of the 21st century. The flames are still burning. They already had their man. They said he was hiding in the mountains of Afghanistan. We asked to see the evidence they said they couldn't show. This is war, they said, and that's all you need to know. America, you're scaring me, you're making me ashamed. You're going out for blood and I can't let you do it. Not in my American name. You want to talk about the body count? Well, let's run it up the mast. Almost 3,000 people died in that New York City blast. And there's about 5,000 people every month that you kill, strangling Iraq for a dirty dollar bill. And you want to talk about brutality? All right, let's get it out. Depleted uranium, now what's that all about? Innocent victims, can you even see their tears? Irradiated homelands for 4 billion years. And you want to talk about the terrorists and what makes them run? Well, you taught them everything they know. You even gave them their guns. Every killer with a grudge is just a tool to be used. And then you forget about them until they make the news. America, you're scaring me, you're making me ashamed. You're going out for blood and I can't let you do it. Not in my American name. For an eye is the justice that you claim. Yeah, but the numbers that we're talking about are a whole different game. Millions of people have no safe place to hide. That's not justice, my friend, that's genocide. So I'm gonna have my say, and I'll say it loud and clear. In every crowd, in every corner, every place I can find an ear. And you can try to shut me up, but no matter what you do, I got a right to speak, cause I'm American too. America, you're scaring me and making me ashamed. You're going out for blood and I can't let you do it. Not in my American name. America, you're scaring me and making me ashamed. You're going out for blood and I just can't let you do it. Not in my American name.
And it's in God we trust. So we'll bomb you during Ramadan, turn your world into dust. But pull up on your bootstraps, stand on your own 2 feet, as we blow them off with cluster bombs disguised as something to eat. We stand for freedom and prosperity. So we'll bomb your schools and hospitals, make sure you live in misery, and all you evildoers, and your children and your wives. With our B-52s, we'll show you how we value civilian lives. Give us your hungry, your restless, we'll show you democracy, a military trial, and detention indefinitely. We'll have homeland security, Thomas Ridge, all hail. We may not find the terrorists, but we can throw the left in jail, and we will all be safe, and we shall have no fears. Once our retinas have been scanned, and all the walls have ears, and we're all in good hands. When the FBI is in the know, we're sure they'll look after us, just like they did with COINTELPRO. So hang a flag in the window, all hail to the chief. Follow the leader and suspend your disbelief. Our country, right or wrong, you know what to do. Sing, God bless America. That red, white, and blue. When facing anyone with box cutters, we'll say put up your dukes, as we spend $50 billion on bombers and nukes. We're a beacon of light, and just to make the point, we'll cut taxes on the rich and throw the poor into the joint. And we'll bail out the airlines, get out your green fedoras, and for all you laid off workers, we've got maquiladoras. Yes, capitalism will save us. For have you ever seen a more convincing proof than Enron and Argentina? So hang a flag in the window, all hail to the chief. Follow the leader and suspend your disbelief. Our country, right or wrong, you know what to do. Sing, God bless America. That red, white, and the axis of evil, we'll bomb them down the skids. There'll be no more terrorists once we kill their kids. People may starve and economies may crumble, but those folks will just have to learn to be more humble and give us your money, debt repayments with aplomb, while we scour the map for a country left to bomb. And as another city falls on our sacred American soil, at least we've got our daisy cutters and that Alaskan oil. So hang a flag in the window, all hail to the chief. Follow the leader and suspend your disbelief. Our country, right or wrong, you know what to do. Sing, God bless America, that red, white, and blue.
David Rovick's Hang a Flag in the Window, and that was coming right after Jim Page's song, My American Name, performed live on this program a few weeks ago here in our studios. And this is Rockin' the Boat on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Today is July 3rd, 2002, and we're discussing patriotism today. I want to thank my first guest, Michael Parenti, for joining me on the phone earlier. I'm going to play music, and we'll be coming back shortly with an interview with Cecilia O'Leary, Assistant Professor of History at CSUMB. Stay tuned to Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM.
Hotel. Right next to Bob's, don't make a start. We loot the world and we can't even feed ourselves. A real test of strength is tearing up the war toys to sell the world. Just carry on, thankful to be born like worms. Hold glory for a blanket as you suck in your thumbs. Real freedom scares you, it's a means of responsibility. So you chicken out. What can just one of us do against all that money and power trying to crush us into roaches? We won't destroy society in a day until we change ourselves first from the inside out. We can start by not lying so much and treating other people like dirt. It's so easy not to base our lives on how much we can stand. You know it feels good to lift that monkey up off the head.
Rocking the boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM. My name is the V-Man. I'm your host every Wednesday from 2 to 5 p.m. here at 96.3 FM. And I want to remind you that we are always in need of your support out there. And if you liked today's interview with Michael Perenni, or if you've heard anything else that you enjoy on Free Radio Santa Cruz, well, please send us a donation today to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. And checks can be made out to FRSC or Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can write that in the payable to line now. So please make that out today and send it to Free Radio Santa Cruz, P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. I want to say hi to all our web listeners out there today at www.microradio.net/FRSC. There on our website, you can tune into our broadcasts from anywhere in the world. And you can also find out information about our programming and a little bit of history of our station. You can find applications if you want to get a program of your own here on our station up on the website as well. There is ordering instructions for t-shirts. That's right. We do now have Freak Radio Santa Cruz t-shirts available from us for the low, low price of $15. These are organic cotton t-shirts, and they come in two colors, black and army green. There's two styles to choose from, and one is a free. You should just go to the website, www.microradio.net/FRSC, and there you'll find all of what I was just talking about. So thank you in advance. I'm going to roll along here with the next interview. Dr. Cecilia Elizabeth O'Leary is Assistant Professor of History and co-director of the Oral History Archive at California State University, Monterey Bay. She is the author of the book To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism. In 1999, she received a Huntington Fellowship to begin research on her next book project, The Construction of Western Americanism at the Borders of Empire. Her background includes being a Smithsonian Fellow and a Landmarks Scholar at the National Museum of American History. Her area of expertise is U.S. cultural history, public history, and California state history. She received her Ph.D. from the University of California at Berkeley in 1995. Dr. Cecilia O'Leary begins in this interview with her reaction to the June 26th Federal Appeals Court ruling that the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance is an unconstitutional endorsement of religion. Dr. Cecilia O'Leary.
I think it's an important decision. I think that particularly in the wake of September 11th, that it's time for us to debate and question and rethink not only the wording of the Pledge of Allegiance, but even if we want to have our school children pledging a daily loyalty oath.
Mm-hmm. I think it's particularly poignant that they actually included that in their ruling about the impressionability of school children. I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little more for our listeners.
Well, a little history might be helpful. The first pledge, in fact, that was very popular before the one that we currently use, that was recited in public schools in the 1890s, in fact, had the word God in it. And it was, we give our head and our hearts to God and country, one nation, one language, one flag. And that was written at a time when there was, you know, a massive immigration of Southern and Eastern Europeans. And across the East Coast in particular, where the public schools were beginning to get organized at the end of the 19th century, there was a great concern among particularly Anglo-Saxon middle-class reformers that these new immigrants were somehow going to weaken the Anglo-Saxon traditions of the United States, that because they were overwhelmingly working class, that their children were going to create chaos by joining unions, by striking, by becoming anarchist workers. And so the intent of the pledge movement in the very beginning was really to enforce social control. And it was a part of a whole movement that saw the schools as really machines for political socialization. So when the immigrant children were taught to say, "We give our heads and our hearts to God and our country, one nation, one language, one flag," it was really about discipline and the emphasis on creating a disciplined workforce. And when Francis Bellamy in 1892 wrote the pledge that we now use, he was a Christian socialist. He was both a minister and a socialist. When he wrote the words of the pledge that we now recite, he reflected in his diaries, and these are his words, that he thought that this pledge that was popular about giving the heads and hearts to God and country was a pretty childish form of words. And he did not purposely put in the word God into his pledge. And instead, what he tried to do with the pledge is think about, well, okay, what can I write that maybe has a little bit more resonance with our history, that could create a social citizenry where the emphasis isn't on just rote memorization and socialization, but brings up some of the ideas behind what this country is about. And he even entertained the idea of putting in the slogan from the French Revolution, which was equality, liberty, and fraternity. And the notion of equality was extraordinarily radical. I mean, it continues to be an extraordinarily radical concept even today. But particularly at the end of the 19th century, as we enter into the 20th century, there was a tremendous pitched battles between working class and the capitalist class. There was a major railway strike that happened in the 1870s where the newspapers even had headlines that said "Communism in the West," solely because railway workers were striking for better working conditions. So Bellamy thought twice. He said, "Well, I don't think folks are ready for the French Revolutionary slogan. So what I'm going to put in the pledge is liberty and justice for all." And even that was quite a stretch to say liberty and justice for all. And what he said in his diaries, which I found up in Upper State, New York, in the University of Rochester archives, is he said, I'm going to leave it for later generations to decide whether we're a capitalist or a socialist country. So the intent of his pledge, in fact, was to get children to think about what's the future of this country. But in fact, what happened to his pledge was that it was turned into a ritual that just degenerated into memorization, where now when children say the pledge, I know different friends of mine who teach grammar school, they say the kids think that they're pledging their allegiance to Richard Stans and want to know who this man is, Richard Stans. So what turned out to be, what started out as a pledge that was not supposed to enforce social coercion among children, in fact, has become its opposite, which is to create tremendous pressure for children just to pledge an uncritical kind of lockstep allegiance that doesn't question what our flag represents, but instead to have some pledging allegiance to my country, right or wrong.
Mm-hmm. Webster's dictionary defines the term patriot as, one quote, one who loves his country and zealously supports its authorities and interests. Listed as a synonym along with this definition is the word nationalist, and I'm curious what thoughts you have on this particular definition of the term patriot.
Well, do you know what year of Webster's dictionary that is?
I think that's 97 from my memory.
97. Could you just repeat that in terms of a zealous?
Sure. It says, quote, one who loves his country and zealously supports its authority and interests, end quote.
Well, that's very interesting that they use the term zealously protects the interests of their country. I mean, I think that by and large, patriotism is defined by someone who sees their own self-interest tied up with the interests of the nation-state. And I think that zealously protects and is in fact what has become of patriotism more often than not, particularly in times of war, where instead of being a patriot, meaning to be someone who democratically participates in the nation and the nation's relationships with peoples not only in the United States but internationally, instead it's been something that's degenerated into, too often than not, a mindless my country right or wrong, which has been very anti-democratic. So in fact, even though I don't agree with that definition, that a patriot is also a zealot, I think a patriot should be someone who furthers critical inquiry and democratic participation. In fact, I think it's quite accurate in terms of what historically has happened in the United States. And I think if we look at, for example, the Spanish-American War, when the U.S. was fighting its first imperialist war halfway across the world, during that war, basically the whole notion of a patriot was to be an imperialist, and there was an incredible anti-imperialist movement that developed in opposition to that definition. In fact, that movement said, how can you be a republic and a democracy and also be imposing an imperialism on people around the world? So there was a struggle over the meaning of patriot then. Then during World War I, you had a passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts, where basically any opposition to the war was absolutely silenced. You had Eugene Debs, who simply in a speech questioned the war and said that he thought it was in the interest of capitalists, and he was imprisoned. You had what I'd call ethnic profiling, similar to racial profiling, where German Americans, and this took place in Santa Cruz, in the city that you're broadcasting from, anyone who is suspected of being German-American, many German-Americans changed their names trying to disguise that they weren't German-Americans because they didn't want to become the targets of angry mobs. Anyone suspected of not having enough patriotism or possibly of being German-American, crowds of people would form around them and demand that they kiss the flag. And when people refused to kiss the flag, they would be, you know, taken into their county jail. And in one example, in the Midwest, a man, because he refused to kiss the flag, was sentenced to 20 years of hard labor in the state penitentiary. And when the appeals judge heard his case, he said, "You've been more sinned against than you've sinned." He said, "I wish I could reverse this decision, but I can't in terms of the legislation that's been passed, the wartime legislation." And in fact, he said, "I think that what this represents is that we've descended back into the Salem witch trials again." And so you had an incredible amount of coercion and irrational zealot patriotism coming to the fore during World War One, and then during World War Two, which no one can disagree that that wasn't a just war. I mean, it was a war against fascism, very little opposition to it. But during that war, you had the racialization of patriotism. You had Japanese Americans, again, right in the towns surrounding the city that you're broadcasting from, who were rounded up. They were put into the Salinas Rodeo grounds and held there before they were then sent out to internment camps around the country. And there wasn't a single act of treason that was found against a Japanese American. And in fact, while Japanese Americans, mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, cousins, nephews, nieces were being placed in internment camps, you had one of the most celebrated units of World War II being made up of Japanese Americans. And so there you have the contradiction, where patriotism is supposed to hold out democracy, but too often it degenerates into the cause of zealotry. And that, in fact, is why I entitled my book, To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism, a paradox. Because American patriotism holds out the ideals that are in the Declaration of Independence, but it's practiced, we often find, particularly during times of war, that in the words of Barbara Lee, we become what we're fighting against. And then during the Korean War, Cold War, we have the whole attack on supposed communists inside the United States, the Red Scare, when people who simply signed a petition, you know, in favor of fair housing or, you know, jobs for the unemployed, found that their careers, their lives were destroyed. And then most recently during the Vietnam War, because an entire generation that I was a part of felt that the U.S. had betrayed the principles that we'd been brought up to believe it stood for, you know, formed an anti-war movement. And the FBI, totally illegally, sent in agent provocateurs to disrupt peaceful demonstrations, to infiltrate classrooms where professors were teaching, to take notes on their lectures, turned us basically into spies where we spied against each other and, you know, questioned each other's integrity. That became the basis of what it meant to be a patriot, rather than a patriot is someone that upholds its country to its ideals and says, no, you know, this war in Vietnam is unjust. Well, I think that being a patriot shouldn't be defined by just zealotry. I think being a patriot is someone who upholds ideals and critically questions the direction this country is going in.
Oftentimes, one way people express their dissent is by burning the flag. And as you note in your book, a lot of the symbols of patriotism, you know, and these rituals that we go through are somewhat new in our history. I mean, this country, we're about to celebrate 226 years of independence, you know, tomorrow, and I'm just struck by how recent many of these, you know, rituals are. As you pointed out earlier, the pledge wasn't written until 1891, 1892, and also the Flag Desecration Act wasn't even implemented until 1968. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this.
Well, what I think it tells us is that oftentimes, particularly the religious right and conservative Republicans and Democrats, you know, hold up the 4th of July, the Star-Spangled Banner, Memorial Day, the Pledge of Allegiance, as if they're sort of timeless consensual representations of American culture. But in fact, they're relatively very recent inventions, and most of them got invented or institutionalized after the Civil War, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and even into our time, as you're saying, in terms of the Flag Desecration Act. So what this means is that instead of these being symbols that are timeless, that represent the majority will, instead they're symbols and rituals that, in fact, if we look at history, we'll find that they've been deeply contested, that there's been struggles over what their meaning should be. And I think to this day, there's struggles over what the meaning of the flag is. And too often we take, with our mass media and mainstream media, you know, and pronunciations that come out of the White House, that the meaning of the flag and patriotism was all sewn up to just represent, for example, what President Bush has to say about the recent Ninth Court decision that found the pledge unconstitutional, where he says, you know, this goes against 200 years of our history. It doesn't go against 200 years of our history. It was only in 1954 that Eisenhower allowed the words "under God" to be added to the pledge. And even then, it was in the height of the Cold War. It was to assert ourselves, the United States, against a godless communism, you know, that we're the God-fearing nation. But in fact, it was the Knights of Columbus, which is a conservative Catholic organization. I know it well because my grandfather was in it. I remember seeing his Knights of Columbus sword and his sash on the bed before he'd get ready to go to meetings. It was the Knights of Columbus who agitated that "under God" be placed in the pledge. So it's not as if this is going against 200 years of history. In fact, it's going against a decision that was made in 54 that was highly questionable at the time. It was politically and ideologically inserted into the pledge against both a godless communism in the Soviet Union, as well as part of the Cold War and the Red Scare here in the United States, against anyone who might not, you know, conform to what a godly person was considered. And that really has nothing to do with citizenship. I mean, belief in God or not a belief in God is really a private opinion that should take place in churches. The Pledge of Allegiance isn't a prayer.
In a June 28th opinion piece entitled "Trivializing a Big Issue, Exactly Who's Victimized by the Existence of the Words Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance," the editors of the Daily Santa Cruz Sentinel ask the following. Quote, "In a world in which innocent people are murdered, in which people lose their life's savings because of lying and cheating by financial leaders, in which schools are failing, who really wants to worry about two words in the Pledge of Allegiance?" The editors go on to state, in part, "We can't imagine that any single person has been prevented from pursuing his or her freedom of expression in any way because of those two words in the Pledge of Allegiance. What next? Recalling all coins and dollar bills because of the 'In God We Trust' line?" Cecilia O'Leary, what is your reaction to this opinion piece?
Well, I both agree and disagree with it. I agree with it in the point it's making that all of, you know, the pronouncements coming out of the Congress and from President Bush is hyperbole. I mean, everybody has come out, you know, wrapped themselves in the flag, pledging allegiance on the steps, you know, outside of Congress, you know, taking up all of the space in the newspapers, when in fact what just happened was that the Supreme Court just ruled that vouchers were okay in Cincinnati, which basically means that taxpayers' money is going to go to support religious schools, which is a very serious decision in terms of violation of separation of church and state. So at that level, I think they're absolutely right. I think the Republicans really wanted to use this decision as a way to wrap themselves in the flag. I mean, Bush came out and even said, you know, this shows why my court-appointed judges need to go through and the Democrats have to hold up their appointments. I mean, that's just political hay. I mean, in fact, the judge who wrote the opinion was a Nixon appointee. He's a moderate Republican. It has nothing to do with what judges Bush is trying to appoint. I mean, this judge is a Republican judge. So they're being very ideological in terms of how they're trying to use this. And, of course, the Democrats just jumped right on the bandwagon immediately and said, oh, no, you're not going to outdo us. We're going to show that, you know, we support the Pledge of Allegiance as well. So I think it's fairly hypocritical and opportunistic in terms of how it's being used, and there's deeper issues that we need to be talking about in terms of separation of church and state. So I agree with them in that point. But I disagree that it's not important. I think it is important, because I think that having children make a loyalty oath, the Constitution, nowhere in the Constitution does it mandate a loyalty oath being made every single day. I think that we have to really think about, is that the form and the direction that we want patriotic education to go in our schools? Because after September 11th, after several decades of the pledge really ceasing to be used in the public schools and teachers coming up with much more inventive classroom discussions and exercises and ways of teaching children how to become Democrats and participants in this country, all of a sudden there was a great cry that went up among local school boards and state legislatures to reinstitute a daily pledging of allegiance. So I think it does matter, and I think it's not a minor thing that even for 30 seconds a day, I mean, it's in terms of children saying a pledge, that we're turning patriotic, what it means to be a patriot, into a daily catechism recital in the schools. I think we need to think about that. I don't think that makes sense in terms of trying to educate children who will be our next leaders. In a world where we now are fighting a war supposedly with no borders and no end. I mean, I don't think we want to just create mindless kids who march in lockstep and don't question the country critically. So I both agree and disagree with that editorial.
Again, we're speaking with Cecilia O'Leary. She is a professor of American history at the California State University at Monterey Bay, and she's also the author of the book To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism. I just have a few more questions for you, if that's okay, Cecilia?
Yes, I can. I have about 5 more minutes.
Okay, great. So I guess let's try to wrap this up. I have 2 more. Kind of bouncing off what you were just talking about, what the pledge now, is this mandatory for students to recite every day? What about students who are foreign exchange students who may have allegiance to another country? Are they mandated, or is it mandatory that they recite the pledge every day?
Well, as of now, in 1943, the Supreme Court decided that you cannot force children to have to say the Pledge of Allegiance. This came after thousands of Jehovah's Witnesses had been persecuted, their children expelled from the schools because they don't feel that they should be having to pledge allegiance to a power and place above God, which is the nation. So you had incredible oppression of Jehovah's Witnesses that took place. And so the Supreme Court finally decided in 43, no, you can't force children to say the Pledge of Allegiance. But what we have now is you have school boards basically encouraging their schools to say the Pledge of Allegiance every morning, but if a child wants to dissent and sit down and not say the Pledge of Allegiance, they can't then expel that child from school. But you have to realize, and I think we all do, that it would take an extraordinarily courageous child to basically stand up to his 20, 30, 40, 50 classmates who are being led by their teacher and pledging allegiance and to say, no, I'm sitting this one out. I'm not going to do that. And in fact, there's a very moving example from World War One, where an African-American child, Herbert Eves, that I found in my research, he basically said, I'm not going to salute the flag till the flag can salute me. Mm-hmm. And what he was protesting, which is quite courageous for his day and age, and was that African-Americans during the end of the 19th, early 20th century were being lynched constantly in the South. And the federal government had not outlawed lynching, had taken no steps to stop this. And so what he was saying was that if my flag stands for a country that allows lynching of African Americans, then I'm not going to pledge my loyalty to it, which I think that was an act of a patriot. And for doing that, he was expelled from school, and the school took him before a court to be tried for being a disloyal citizen, for being a traitor. And the judge said, I cannot try this child. I have no grounds for putting this child in jail at this point for refusing to pledge allegiance. So the school was forced to take the child back. But can you, I mean, that's just quite extraordinary. And there's not, that's an unusual child that's going to be willing to stand up, or that's going to also be able to step outside of the pressure of school and form their own opinion and be able to have the wherewithal to go up against not only a school but also a judge in terms of critiquing what they think the United States is doing. In fact, the Pledge of Allegiance, and initially the way it was written, it not only didn't include God, but it didn't include the flag of the United States of America. That was added after World War One, when 100% Americanizers, those were people, the American Legion was very prominent among the 100% Americanizers, who really saw what it meant to be an American as being white and Anglo-Saxon and Protestant. And so they added the flag of the United States because they wanted to make sure there were no children, fifth columnists, who were secretly pledging allegiance to another country. So you have the history of this flag being one that was that's been grossly distorted from its original intent when it was written to create a social citizenry, and instead it's become a pledge that's trying to seek out, you know, conniving fifth columnist children, or, you know, asserting ourselves against a godless communism when the Cold War is over. We're not fighting the Cold War any longer. And so you really have a situation where, though it's not something that children have to say, just to be realistic, children are not going to be able to stand outside and protest this in any kind of way. You know, that you could expect from a first grader, a second grader, a third grader, fourth, fifth, seventh, eighth.
Right. I do have two more quick questions. I know you have to be going, but I wanted to get these two in. Mm-hmm. First, how is the U.S. flag exploited by advertisers?
Oh, that's such an important issue, because the patriotism, the struggle over whether patriotism represents the ideals in the Declaration of Independence that we need to struggle each generation to realize, or whether it's something that just sells, has been a struggle that's been with us since practically the beginning of the founding of this country. Certainly at the end of the 19th century, when modern advertising begins to take off. The flag and its commercial purposes, it goes back, even after the Civil War, there were struggles over the use of the flag. Veterans, after the Civil War, were very concerned that the flag both represent the fact that they'd lost almost an entire generation, either to death during the Civil War, or certainly to being either psychologically or physically maimed by it. So they wanted patriotism to represent some a higher dignity. But immediately after the Civil War, you saw furniture advertisers. I found one advertisement that had, it was an enormous full-page ad, and it was for furniture, and it said, you know, men fought and died in the Civil War, and what does it mean to fought and die in the Civil War on the side of the United States? doesn't it really mean fighting? And I'm paraphrasing now, for home and family. And then it said, and what is home and family but your house? And then it said, but what is your house but furniture? And furniture in your house. Remember, when you go to buy your bedroom set, to choose well, because in the end, men fought and died in the Civil War for the furniture that you now have in your bedroom. Which, I mean, is so hypocritical. And after September 11th, I saw an Ethan Allen ad for furniture with a bed wrapped in a flag, which again said, you know, buy American. And I thought, oh my God, you know, it's the commercial ownership of patriotism, where after September 11th, when Bush finally opened the airports, you know, instead of him saying we have to really, you know, strive to continue to, you know, have this kind of outpouring of patriotism that we've seen in these last week, you know, people giving blood, people giving money to support the victims, people willing to go into their communities and think about what public service might mean. No, that's not what he said. He said, buy your tickets on the airlines and fly to Florida to visit Disneyland. And I thought, God, we've been reduced to the United Corporations of America. Yeah.
And finally, as we embark on this Independence Day weekend with the vague threats of possible terrorist attacks on tourist attractions all across the United States, the threat of never-ending war, and the knowledge that over 2 million people in this country currently reside behind bars, my biggest question for you is, do we have anything to celebrate this 4th of July?
I think that the 4th of July is a really important time to think about, to read the Declaration of Independence, to think about the fact that this country was founded in the contradiction of being a country that promised freedom, but at the same time enslaved Africans, and that to go back to something that Frederick Douglass said, who was an ex-slave who had fled to freedom, and in 1852, when he was speaking in front of a white audience on the 4th of July, he said, this 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. I think that this is a time to think about, what is this 4th of July? Who is it for? What, you know, are the ideals in the Declaration being upheld? Are they being upheld not only nationally, but globally? And how are we going to make a celebration of the 4th of July not just mean buying, you know, canvas chairs and beer bottles wrapped in the flag, but instead have it be a time when we rethink, okay, if we believe in these ideals, how are we making sure that this nation is living up to them?
Thank you very much, Cecilia O'Leary, and I want to offer you this opportunity if you have any final thoughts to share with our listeners.
Simply to really... I think go get a copy of the Declaration of Independence, think about it, and consider what are the paradoxes that we continue to have to struggle against, and whether our patriotism after September 11th is going to be one that expands the rights of citizenship, or it's going to be one that curtails civil liberties, and whether or not we're going to fight during these uncertain times. And I think they're just going to become more uncertain, as there will probably be attacks in the future, that to be a patriot, I think we have to really guard civil liberties, we have to guard equality under the law, and we really have to be voices of conscience in the United States. And we have to rethink seriously about whether we want to reclaim the flag for a progressive agenda, whether it's possible to reclaim it or not.
All right. Well, I really appreciate your time this morning, Cecilia O'Leary. You're a professor at the CSUMB, California State University at Monterey Bay. And is there any other information that you would advise our listeners to seek?
Well, if they would like to learn more about what's been the history of patriotism in this country, you could read To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism, that I've written. And you can get that at any local bookstore or on Amazon.com.
And that's available through Princeton University Press?
Yes.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Cecilia.
Okay, bye-bye.
I was born inside a hospital with a 9-digit number code. I pledged allegiance to the flag when I was only 4 years old. The first thing that I learned in school is we are a country free. One bad force is attack our land. I'll fight for my country. I'll fight for my country. I joined the Scouts when I was 12 and put on a uniform. I learned there how to fold the flag and how the look of a proud man was worn. We camped in the mountains, deserts and plains. We hiked through the giant trees. And I saw God in the beauty there. I'll fight for my country. I'll fight for my country. With a heavy pack and a cluttered mind, the young man walks all alone. 6,000 miles away he finds, for the first time that he feels at home. And he laughs to himself as he faces his fear in the land of the mighty grizzly. It once was like this everywhere. I'll fight for my country. It once was like this everywhere. I'll fight for my country. Now I love this river, love this land, and I love my green mountain home. And when they come to cut the forest here, they won't be fighting me alone. 'Cause the wildlands are the places we go to remember what it means to be free. When bad forces attack our land, I'll fight for my country. I'll fight for my country. I'll fight for my